by John Clee for the Kentucky Oral History Commission with Mr. Frank Snodgrass, who is the Vice President and Managing Director of the Burley and Dark Leaf Tobacco Export Association. The interview is being conducted in Lexington, Kentucky at the offices of the Burley Tobacco Growers Cooperative Association on July the 9th, 1985. Could we start out, maybe you just tell me a little bit about your background?
Well, John, I was born in a small community called Smith's Grove, Kentucky, back in 1920. And I completed my high school education there and attended the Bowling Green Business University, which was later merged with Western Kentucky University. And while I was going to school, I worked for a leaf tobacco dealer and exporter part-time to pay my way through college. I was drafted into World War II and became an officer in the combat engineers and survived World War II, and then I returned to take up my employment in 1943 at the same organization.
What was the name of that organization that you worked at?
It was J.E. Bohannon Tobacco Company.
And what kind of tobacco did they handle mostly?
Both burley and dark kinds of tobacco for domestic and export customers. They did processing, stemming, and re-drying of tobacco. In 1945, I was asked to join the Burley Tobacco Growers Cooperative Association of Lexington, Kentucky, in their processing and sales department, and I worked in that capacity until January 1, 1960, when I assumed the position of Vice President and Managing Director of the Burley and Dark Leaf Tobacco Export Association with headquarters in Washington, D.C. At that time, the organization also maintained headquarters in the offices of the Burley Tobacco Growers Association in Lexington, Kentucky, who are the principal benefactor and financial supplier for the organization. The Burley and Dark Leaf Tobacco Export Association is composed of 13 member associations representing the growers, auction warehousemen, dealers, and exporters of the burley and dark kinds of tobacco. That organization was formed in 1943 and has been in existence since that time.
Now, you said it's a kind of a combination or amalgamation of different associations. Is that how it gets its funding, through the different associations?
Yes.
Sales? Or?
Yes, the funding is furnished by the various member associations. In the case of the Burley Association, of headquartered in Lexington, Kentucky, and the one headquartered in Knoxville, Tennessee, their funds come from the Burley Checkoff Program.
Yes.
That the growers participate in. The purpose of the organization is to is to promote the domestic and export use of burley and dark leaf kinds of tobacco. We are also charged with the liaison at the national level with the executive, legislative, and branches of the government. We maintain liaison and do the lobbying for the member associations in that capacity.
I see. Let me take one of those at a time. You mentioned that the association promotes domestic and export use. How do you go about doing that? Do you hire lobbyists, or how do you?
No, we are primarily a one-man, one-girl organization, and when Congress is not in session, well, I travel extensively abroad. I've been around the world 27 times in the last 25 years. I participated in all the trade negotiations since World War II in some official capacity with the United States government to gain freer access for our tobacco in the foreign markets. We started out, when I assumed the position in 1960, we were exporting about 30 million pounds of burley tobacco. In recent years, we've surpassed 150 million pounds, but I don't take credit for that. The credit should go primarily to the GIs during World War II and the Vietnam and Korean conflict that gave away free cigarettes throughout the world and encouraged the taste for an American-type blended cigarette. Of course, our dealers and exporters and U.S. manufacturers have also been participating in promoting the use of American leaf.
Now, you said you have to work fairly closely, I guess, with government people because some of these negotiations for sales of tobacco, is that because other nations, their government runs a lot of their economy? And
well, in a number of nations, the whole tobacco industry is a monopoly, owned and controlled by the government. But the reason I keep liaison with the United States federal government is because our program is oriented in the Department of Agriculture. The Treasury Department, the Labor Department has much to say about the taxes and the labor regulations for tobacco manufacturing and distribution. And of course, we closely align with the members of Congress, particularly those from the tobacco-producing states, to try to encourage the legislation that would be in the best interest of our membership.
Let me go from kind of a historical look and then from a regional viewpoint. When you became very active in this organization in 1960, who were some of the foreign customers then? And maybe talk a little bit about each one of those.
Well, back at that time, the countries that later formed the European Community, primarily Germany, Holland, Luxembourg, Belgium, and the other Scandinavian countries, were the principal purchasers of U.S. tobacco, that is, burley and dark kinds of tobacco. The British market has been strictly a straight Virginia type or Fluker type traditionally. Now it is changing to an American type blended cigarette.
What you say, it's just a matter of taste then for these foreign markets. They just almost have to develop a taste for the American blended that uses our burley tobacco?
Yes, that's true. And of course, I give credit to that, to the servicemen who gave away cigarettes. We now, our largest number one customer is Japan. And there's Thailand, Taiwan, South Korea, and a number of countries in the Far East that in recent years, in the last 20 years, have developed strictly an American-type blended cigarette.
And that could maybe go back to the Vietnam War when our soldiers were there in Korea.
That's very possible.
Now what about, can you describe some of your experiences or maybe talk about these different countries? What kinds of, the Germans, what kind of people were they to deal with?
Well, the Germans are very shrewd businessmen. They are very intelligent individuals. If you know your subject, they're very easy to deal with. But if you don't know your subject, you're at quite a disadvantage.
I
had the unfortunate position of being an officer in Germany on the opposing forces, and many of the contacts that I've made in the last 20 or 25 years have been with former people that I was fighting, and I've become very good friends of theirs. And we often talk about our Army experience and then relate it to our present-day business experience.
So they Is that market still pretty strong today?
It has not been the last 2 years, primarily due to the high taxation that they put on tobacco products for economical reasons. But I am very much in hopes it will come back. I've just returned from Europe, and indications are that in Germany there'll be the demand will be about the same as last year. Mm-hmm. However, in Scandinavian countries and in southern Europe, such as Spain, Portugal, I look for some increases to occur.
What accounts for that?
The economy, primarily. I guess cigarettes are more closely attuned to the economy than any other item, because a man's first going to buy his food and clothing, and then the next number one luxury is his cigarettes.
What about the Scandinavian countries? What kind of situation did you... Now, the German, before I leave that, they are a monopoly, is that right?
No, the Germans is free enterprise.
It's free enterprise, so you're dealing with a lot of different people.
That's right. The primary monopolies, we'll get off of that subject, are in Egypt, Spain, Portugal, up until they joined the common market, Greece. Italy had a monopoly, and now they're in the common market, and there's no place for one. Austria has a monopoly. And then in the Far East, it is Thailand, Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea are your principal ones.
They're monopolies. So do you deal directly with, I guess you're dealing with government officials in those situations?
Well, they're semi-government officials. In most instances, tobacco is the number one taxable item in each of those countries. Therefore, it's a very high priority as to who heads up the monopoly. And they're usually responsible to the finance minister. It might be of interest to you to know that in Egypt alone, the taxes from tobacco brings in more money into the government than the tolls charged on the Suez Canal, which is a very busy waterway.
I wanted to go ahead and ask you about some of these countries and some of the people we've dealt with. The Scandinavian countries, are they, what kind of people do you deal with there? What kinds of?
Well, now, Scandinavia has also broken up any monopoly or and it's free enterprise. Very intelligent people. Most of them have been in the tobacco business for a number of years. They're good businessmen. They have good funding. You have no problem with anyone in Scandinavia. They use both the dark fired tobacco for snuff and cigars, and the burley tobacco for cigarettes.
Now, as you said, you're kind of a one-person operation, but now you make contacts with these people and then get back in touch with these various associations and cooperatives.
Yes.
And actually make the sales?
No, I do not make the sales. They are made through the normal channels of trade with independent businessmen that are dealers and exporters. My job is to promote it, to assist in eliminating trade barriers, and to make it more easily accessible to the American businessmen when they call on.
So if we have a domestic tobacco company here, and you're just out there kind of trying to make the path a little easier for them.
Yes, that's probably the best way to describe it.
Now, for example, here at the co-op, they have this what's called pool tobacco. They
do not sell direct.
Right.
So it has to be sold through
a dealer. Yeah.
And
so when a dealer gets an order, he'll come to the co-op and say, I need this much tobacco to fill this order and
proceed. That's correct.
Now, you mentioned trade barriers. I'll get back to talking about some of these countries, but in your 25 years of experience, how has that, has it been a fairly consistent trade relationship with these countries? Have they changed drastically? Or?
Well, there's been changes both ways. Some of it, the trade barriers have been eliminated. Others have picked up new trade barriers. After the formation of the European Economic Community, they set up a buyer's premium for tobacco, whereby a buyer, if he bought from the loan stock tobaccos that had gone under loan at a high level, would be given a rebate. In addition to that, they would also pay the ocean freight to the nearest point of competition. In other words, if the Japanese bought some burley tobacco from the Italian holding loan association, they would get a rebate on purchasing it, and they would pay the ocean freight on it as far as South Korea, which is the nearest point of competition. So that's something that our tobacco growers have not been able to compete with.
So you're talking about within the European common market, their own tobacco, which they grow, is kind of subsidized through these relationships.
That's very definite. And consequently, it's taken over a large percentage of the content of the cigarettes and tobacco products produced within that community. And they're also competing for third world trade.
They're competing to export also.
Yes. On the other side, the Japanese are gradually lowering their barriers to permit freer trade to go in there. So you've got two different situations.
Well, now, when you came into this position in the early 60s, the Europeans were they the biggest?
Oh, very definitely. Yes.
Now that has shifted more now towards what? The Far East?
Far East and Middle East.
Let's talk about the Far East for a minute then. The Japan, Thailand, Taiwan, Taiwan and South Korea. You say the Japanese have eased their restrictions a little bit.
Yes, they have. Both on American manufactured products, which was the largest holdup that we had in there. Mm-hmm. And also, they've cut back on the production of competing tobaccos within Japan. They're using their land to produce food and permitting imports of greater quantities of foreign-produced tobacco.
Now, the Japanese, is smoking quite a habit over there?
Oh, yes. It's very, very much a habit. It's our largest customer.
Currently, right now,
yes.
As far as the foreign market, what about the competition there? What other markets do they look to? Who's competing with us there?
On the Japanese, by and large, have the highest quality of raw product of any nation in the world, including this nation, and the large percentage of their leaf purchases come from the United States, both flue-cured and burley. Now, there's competition being established throughout the world, primarily in burley tobacco and flue-cured tobacco, and one of those is South Korea, that they've got quite a bit lower labor costs than South Korea, and we can't compete there. And now they're moving into Thailand to use the cheap labor there to grow more tobacco. Some associates of mine just returned from Red China, and the Chinese had a group of college professors from the agronomy department of a university here in the United States teaching them to grow higher quality tobacco in China. So that's something we have to look for all the time.
Yeah, we kind of our own worst enemy there. We like to share this technology, but we sometimes hurt ourselves, I guess, in the end. Is there any possibilities with Red China as far as being a market for us?
I would say that they're more likely to be an import market, the United States to be an import market from them, because their average income is about 30 cents a day. And they can't buy much $2 tobacco from the United States on that kind of income.
So they might be importing,
exporting
to
us.
Yeah, right.
That's always a serious danger.
With you going throughout this world travel, how difficult is that for you as an individual? Your family life.
Well, it's been very rewarding. In the early years, it gave me an opportunity to see a lot of the world that I normally would not have seen. But after you've been to a country once or at most twice, it's just like going to the office every day. It becomes drudgery. I've made a number of friends throughout the world in high places, and I cherish that friendship that I've established.
Have you been into countries where there have been upheavals and problems, and you've seen those unfolded, particularly in regards to importing and exporting products?
Oh yes, very definitely. That's a continuing thing, and of course the policy of our government is to help emerging nations, underdeveloped nations, and that's spread throughout the world. And most of the seed that they're using to compete with us comes from the United States. Their know-how comes from the United States, either through the hiring of extension agents or from some cooperation with an American manufacturer.
What about the quality of the tobacco over the years that you've had to promote us? Has that been a problem?
Well, we've had problems with our own tobacco. Climatic conditions will cause problems, such as the 83 crop of Burley that we had problems with.
Yes.
But by and large, American-produced Burley and dark tobacco is the hallmark of quality, and they'll pay more for our tobacco than they will for substitutes because of the aroma that's in the tobacco that is not present in other tobaccos.
That's the question, I guess. These countries can buy from other markets and grow some of their own, but there's something special about this tobacco.
That's true. They can only substitute so much, and most of them have gotten down to the point now that they're using our tobacco just for salt and pepper to flavor up and make palatable the tobacco from other producing countries.
Yeah. They've really then reduced the amount that they import from us to the minimum.
Well, we've caused it by holding an umbrella over the world markets with our price support level.
Mm-hmm.
However, our economy has been such that the cost of production would not permit us to make drastic cuts. My first obligation is to the producers of American tobacco, and to try to get their products used at the highest possible price that I can get them sold.
Yeah. The Middle Eastern market, isn't that a relatively new market too?
That's a relatively new market. It's a very flexible market, just as their governments are very flexible. You deal today with some fellow, and you go back 3 months from now, he may be in some other department somewhere. And it's no stability in the emerging nations so far as continuity in positions.
I had read in one place that that smoking's become just almost an obsession with some of the, particularly the Middle Eastern men. Have you noticed any of that?
That's very definite.
On your trips?
Yes, very definite. and also to a lesser degree with the women. They're now taking it up.
Oh, I see. Now, most of the countries you've mentioned that, you know, you traveled to and so forth have been, I guess, what we call free countries. Have there been any contact at all with communist nations?
Yes, I spent quite a bit of time in Poland, in Russia, Czechoslovakia, and I spent 6 weeks in 1959 in Poland and established a cigarette there called a brand named Carmen, which did surprisingly well until political difficulties between the United States and Poland made it impossible for them to get our tobacco to. So the brand is still on sale there, but it's nothing like it was originally.
Well, this, the brand you introduced then was an American blend type.
That is correct.
No long-lasting relationships with any of those countries, though, I guess, as far as buying tobacco on a regular basis.
No, you can't depend on it. And a lot of tobacco is being purchased from Greece, Italy, Turkey, through Bulgaria, and they're manufacturing cigarettes and furnishing the Iron Country, Eastern markets.
Mm-hmm. It's really amazing to think about all the different places you've been to and where you go and what you do. Let's go back to the other part of your responsibility, really, and that's the liaison with the government. Each one of these departments, as you said, the Department of Agriculture, what kinds of dealings do you have with them?
Well, of course, the Department of Agriculture has three primary branches that look after the tobacco program. Mm-hmm. The Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service looks after the price support and the quota system, and we maintain very close liaison with them. The Agricultural Marketing Service looks after the grading of tobacco on the warehouse floor and the certification of tobacco that is entering and the United States and that of tobacco being exported from the United States. The third department is the Foreign Agriculture Service, which has a tobacco division that is charged with the responsibility through their agricultural attachés and counselors to encourage the exportation of farm products and to make available funding, whether it be government funding or guaranteed funding of commercial nature, and they've been very helpful to us.
Now, you mentioned the ASCS, the price and quota branch of that. As that has changed over the years, and of course, most of those changes occurred during your tenure, did that affect you very much? For example, when it went from acreage to poundage on the control,
well,
did that hurt or help the exporting business?
I think it helped the growers, and in reality, it also helped the export end of it, because we had a closer quantitative control of what was being produced.
I see. The way that the tobacco is sold and marketed, has that had any effect? For example, going from the hand tied tobacco to the bale tobacco, I guess that doesn't have too much to do with.
Well, I happen to be an advocate of staying with the bundle tied tobacco. A number of people in Kentucky primarily were very much enthused about going to bale tobacco or sheeted tobacco. My observation with my contacts abroad is that it has deteriorated the quality and also the desirability of American leaf.
Of course, that makes your job harder.
That's
you
right.
Want that desirable quality. Have you personally and the organization been active in some of the recent problems and manipulations to try to save the tobacco program.
Now, that's been handled by a task force from Kentucky primarily, mm-hmm. and we were not involved in it. At the time the meeting started, I was in Europe and spent 6 weeks there and returned about the time that the negotiations had completed. I do commend those people that were active in it. I think that thus far they've done an admirable job.
This is side two of a tape with Frank Snodgrass. We were talking about the different areas of government you have to deal with. Another area you mentioned was the Treasury Department. And of course, they're into the taxation end of it. You've had to, I guess, work pretty hard there whenever you can.
Yes, we've cooperated with the manufacturing segment to try to hold down taxation on tobacco products. Because my experience has been with foreign countries that you can just tax yourself out of a market. The consumer can only stand so much.
Can you think of some examples of that in foreign countries?
Well, the Germans, I gave you that example formerly. The same thing has happened in Great Britain. It's happening in Denmark at the present time. People get on a boat and go to Sweden to get their cigarettes and then return.
Is that right?
That's true.
You know, some of the popular thinking has been that, well, people, you know, that have this habit, they won't restrict it because of the price, but...
Well, a man can only pay so much for a luxury, and then he takes a second guess about continuing that luxury.
The federal government just doubled the tax, what was that, a couple of years ago?
That is correct.
And it's supposed to go off. Do you see that happening, or...
Well, the only thing I know about it is that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee of the House assured the tobacco interest that it would not sunset. It's supposed to sunset as of September 30th of this year, and already there's people have bills in the hopper in Washington to continue the taxation, and in some of them instances to double it from 16 to 32 cents a thousand.
While I'm on that subject, have you seen a difference in perception that people have about the tobacco industry in that 25 years?
Very definitely. Well, it's happened in my personal life. I'm a smoker, uh-huh. and my wife's a smoker. And most of our friends that we visit are non-smokers. We go into their house and we don't see any ashtrays. I think that is the single most important item that the anti-tobacco forces have developed is the making the smoking cigarettes a non-social.
Yeah, it's almost a stigma. Have you seen that happen? The European countries you mentioned that put on this high taxation, did that same kind of thing happen before it happened here? Or is the same attitude?
Whatever the Americans do, the Europeans react double.
Is that right?
Yeah. When the health issue came up in this country in 64 about smoking and health, uh-huh. the Europeans overreacted tremendously, both in Great Britain and Germany. And then when they started talking about insecticides and pesticides, they overreacted and put high restrictions of so many parts per million in the mainstream of the smoke that it was prohibited to use the product.
Yes, that's another thing you've had to deal with as far as those
very definitely.
Foreign restrictions. The Europeans have the highest limits on those kinds of things.
That is correct.
What about the Japanese? Have they reacted to this health issue at all? Or?
The Japanese play it very cool. Mm-hmm. It's a big income producer in Japan.
I see.
And most of the Japanese smoke a good many cigarettes mm-hmm. per day. Mm-hmm. So you don't hear any trouble.
Well, what about, going back to that, the first part of the question, the idea of of even the industry being kind of stigmatized as bad people or bad guys. That wasn't perception in the early 60s or even throughout the 60s, was it?
Well, it goes back even further than that. As a young man, I started out in this tobacco business in 1937. Mm-hmm. Prior to that time, we had people burning barns to keep them from selling it to the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. There was a great stigma on the manufacturers of trying to get the farmer to produce his crop for nothing. Mm-hmm. Well, that subsided in the 60s and 70s, but I see a reoccurrence of it at the present time.
Even with the producer being being mad at the manufacturers?
That is correct.
What about the organizations for Dark Leaf 2? As you said, this is an umbrella association, but are you representing tobacco from throughout the entire South? Or?
Well, from an 8-state area, yes. The dark tobacco is produced primarily in western Kentucky and western Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And, of course, burley is produced in eastern, middle and eastern Tennessee and throughout Kentucky and in western North Carolina, western Virginia, Missouri, Ohio, and Indiana.
Now, just to make the distinction, there is a difference between flue-cured tobacco and dark tobacco.
Oh, very definitely.
What dark tobacco is?
Dark tobacco is, they have what they call a variety of one sucker, mm-hmm. a variety of Green River. Both of those are used primarily in chewing tobacco. Mm-hmm. Dark fire cured, those are, the first two are air cured varieties, mm-hmm. Green River and one sucker. Dark fire cured is actually fired in the barn under hickory smoke, mm-hmm. and it smells very much like a good old Kentucky country ham when it's cured. Uh-huh. In flue cured, they use flues with heat and with fans on it to cure their tobacco. It's a yellow type tobacco. Dark tobaccos are very dark and black, and of course our burley tobacco turns out a tannish color.
Now, the appeal of both these kinds of tobacco, the dark and the burley, for foreign buyers is the taste, the aroma?
Taste and the aroma, yes.
They just can't get the same thing out of their own.
No, but even the dark types, Malawi and Italy, are improving their quality of dark fired tobacco tremendously.
The Middle Eastern countries that I mentioned before, they are, have you traveled in those too?
Oh yes, yes. I try to travel to every country where we sell any tobacco on a two-year basis, every other year, and then to our principal manufacturers annually.
Okay, now, who would you list as your principal manufacturer?
Well, we maintain, I haven't told you this yet, John, but we have promotion programs that we maintain in a number of countries where we have joint advertising to promote brands containing a high percentage of American tobacco.
So you're involved, that's with the, if Germany has a manufacturer there that's using a lot of our tobacco, you will advertise jointly with them.
Well, we do it primarily with countries that are monopolies, so we don't have the competition within the country. At the present time, we have a project going with Egypt, one in Thailand, one in Taiwan. In former years, we've had them in Spain, Austria, in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. Belgium, Luxembourg.
So you can even tell from that the campaigns are going on now in the Middle East and Far East, kind of shifted away from Europe.
That's correct.
Because of use and so forth.
Right.
We didn't mention and talk about the Arabs, the people in the Middle East. Did you find them different than the other people you dealt with?
Well, everybody's different. I don't delve in religion anywhere I go, and I never get into those questions, so it's not a handicap to go into any country.
I see. They don't, the Muslims don't have any particular religious prohibition against smoking.
No.
That's because, you know, a lot of fundamentalism going on there. I guess that could hurt. Where do you see... What's the future look like to you as far as exporting markets?
Well, it all depends on what we do in this country. As I see it, we're the second largest producer of tobacco. China is number one and has been for a number of years.
I see.
But they consume most of their tobacco on their domestic market. We have continued to cut back our quotas, hoping to keep our price support levels at a high level. There's certain types of tobacco that are necessary for export, other types of tobacco that are necessary for the domestic manufacturers, and in a given year, sometimes we don't produce that quantity. The tobacco that goes under loan, even though it came off the same floor where somebody bought a similar pile, gets a stigma on it, and they sometimes hesitant to purchase it. If we can get our loan stocks eliminated through legislation that's now under consideration, I can foresee us going for a number of years and possibly increasing our exports again.
Now, you say that tobacco goes under loan. It does have kind of a stigma with the foreign buyers, or is it just with our own dealers?
Well, with the own, because they had a choice to buy it at one time, and unless the price is right. Oh, our domestic manufacturers have bought hundreds of millions of pounds of pooled tobacco over the years, owing to the change in technology. I can recall back on the 52 crop, which was a green, wet weather crop. Everyone said, dump it in the ocean. And 2 years later, they developed a filter tip cigarette. They needed the strong nicotine in that tobacco to get it through the filter tip. And it went like hotcakes. So as things change, there's always something that'll come along to take you out of the hole.
Through your history with the organization and in the tobacco business, when did imports really start to hurt us?
They started in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something you have to understand that our domestic manufacturers, three of whom are really multinational corporations now, and they operate throughout the world, mm-hmm. Also do growing in certain areas of the world, and they have elaborate research facilities, and they can make a blend and use maybe undesirable tobacco in that blend simply because they have enough volume to spread it throughout the world.
Have those components you just mentioned, one example where the filter came in, they needed a different kind of tobacco. As the health scares become more and more prevalent, are foreign buyers looking for a certain type of tobacco?
Oh, very definitely. That thing has been up and down. The West Germans were the first ones wanted a very low nicotine cigarette. They got a low nicotine cigarette on the market, and people were smoking it more and enjoying it less, and in about a 10-year period, it has reverted back now to where they want a high nicotine cigarette that has some satisfaction. It's an ever-changing situation.
Now, does that have to do, of course, I know that, you know, the dealers are more into actual selling in of this, but, for example, the nicotine content, does that have to do with climatic conditions or where you, you know, what type of tobacco it is, what's the tips or the...
That is correct, yeah. Where it's the stalk position, the climatic conditions, fertilization, all of them are contributing factors to the nicotine.
Yeah. You mentioned before about the quality, and you said that one of the problems you see with quality is less care taken in the marketing, means of marketing, the bales versus the hand tied. What about, of course, another thing that's happened with tobacco farmers is there's a lot more part-time farmers and, you know, they have other jobs. Has that hurt quality, too?
I have not detected that as hurting quality. In other words, a man that has a small allotment and uses his own labor, his family labor for it, usually takes greater care of it than a man that is in commercial production, my judgment. The preparation for market is the difficulty that most of them get in a hurry to get it on market, hope to get it sold before the prices drop on it, and consequently, deteriorates the quality of it.
Of course, years ago, they used to strip tobacco in, five grades and maybe a throwaway grade, which really meant six different kinds.
That's right.
And now, you know, we've even gotten to the point sometimes where they just all strip it together. Is that another thing that's hurt, you think?
Well, it hurts us in the export market. Now, my good friends in the domestic market are responsible for that because they were paying just as much for mixed strip tobacco as they were paying for well-class tobacco.
Yes, sir.
Because they can cut it up and use it, but a small manufacturer abroad, he has to be more careful about what he's buying. He wants his to be strictly to a grade quality.
There are some markets that we haven't mentioned that I guess you haven't. For example, South America, but now South America, I guess they're producing so much of their own.
South America is one of our greatest competitors at present time. Both Brazil and Argentina are producing excellent flue-cured tobacco and are moving now into the burley tobacco.
So that's not going to be a potential market?
No. And the same thing is true in Africa. Malawi market is improving in quality. The old Rhodesian market there is improving. Zambia and Tanzania is improving. The northern Africa, we're attempting now to move into that area because it has been strictly a dark cigarette, as was France for a number of years. They had nothing but dark cigarettes. Now 90% of the French market is American-type filter. So we're now operating in Morocco and Algiers, and we're hoping to get some American tobacco in there very shortly.
What about the Australia, New Zealand, that kind of, is there any market there? Or?
Australia has been a market for a number of years for American leaf, but they went into production of tobacco themselves and brought the know-how from abroad, and while their quality of their burley tobacco is not up to American standards, it still meets the requirements of that market.
If, of course, price is a big thing here. You're talking about that the European manufacturers want our tobacco for that aroma and quality and so forth, and perhaps they'd use more of it if it didn't cost so much.
Well, the price of the American dollar on world exchange is the biggest problem we've got.
I see.
Of course, most foreign produced tobacco is quoted in U.S. dollars, but the exchange is a lot better between, say, a German mark in Rhodesia than it would be in a U.S. dollar. So that's been some of our problem.
So it's not only just the amount that farmers are getting here, but how that translates into a foreign dollar.
That's right.
Now, has that I guess that's gone up and down since.
No, it's been up for the last 10 years. The dollar has been very high. Back in the 70s, the Dutch, who are very shrewd businessmen, were buying dollars much, about half of what they're paying for them today. And you never heard any complaints about the price of American tobacco. But today they're complaining about it. Might be interesting to you, I spent some time in Indonesia last year, where they're going into the production of American tobacco, primarily burley, and there again, they have the cheapest labor anywhere outside of China, I guess, and it's going to be difficult to compete with them.
So that story's repeated throughout the world.
That's right. Their native leaf there is so inferior that the cigarettes they produce with it, they mix with clove, what they call a Kratex cigarette. And you smoke one of them and it pops out on your necktie or your shirt and burns a hole. But they hand produce them. I saw 39,000 women in one factory rolling cigarettes and packaging. So it's amazing.
You use that example, the Indonesian cigarettes. I guess you've seen a lot of tobacco grown in a lot of different countries.
Yes.
Does it really vary a whole lot?
Oh yes, very definitely. But as we keep exporting our technology, it's not going to.
Yeah, they're getting better and better all the time.
That's right.
Do they use auction systems or so forth?
No, only in South Africa do they have auction system. Most of tobacco is sold through receiving stations. Mm-hmm. They'll have a government grader there, and then the buyers cream whatever it comes across. If they don't take it, it automatically goes under loan.
Now, most of the organizations under your umbrella really owe their existence to the producer, don't they, to the farmer?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, the dealers and exporters that are under it, they've been very cooperative.
I see.
Yes.
You know, there's some dubious feeling among some people that they might just let this program go, and that way the dealers and the manufacturers could deal directly and you know, do whatever they wanted to, grow large amounts and tell them how they want it stripped and produced and so forth.
I've heard that theory espoused, but I am doubtful that most of them would like to go anywhere else in the world and set up their headquarters and operate from there. They have huge investment in both processing and manufacturing equipment in this country.
Yes.
So I don't think that the negotiations would have gotten this far if they had any intention of trying to eliminate the American producer.
And you think it's even their interest to keep this program?
They can come up with something better, I think that's true.
What about the people? We talked about how among society, there's this stigmatization of cigarette smokers and cigarettes and tobacco. What about the people in the government that you've worked with? Are they less receptive now, you think?
I don't detect much difference. I've been through, I guess, 8 or 10 administrations, yes, and I don't see much difference in it. I would say this, that the farmer is not as strong politically within the Congress as he was 25 years ago when I went there. At that time, someone from a farming area headed up every committee of any note, and that's no longer true now. And it has become popular for a number of them to take on a status of anti-tobacco. So that's why it's very difficult to get any constructive legislation through for a farmer, and more so for tobacco.
You've dealt with a lot of individuals through the years. are there people that stand out either internationally or nationally that kind of stand out in your mind?
Oh, there's a number of people, but I would hesitate from naming them because that would leave out someone that probably deserved recognition. I've had a wonderful spirit of cooperation from everyone I've dealt with, both in this country and abroad, and I am highly indebted to them for it.
Now, as vice president of this organization, you kind of headed it up.
For the last 25 years, I'm stepping down from that position as of September 30th. I'm now serving capacity as consultant. My replacement is a gentleman by the name of Ben Reeves, who had long service in Washington with Congressman Carl Perkins from Kentucky, and he's just returned from China and is now in Washington looking after the chores there.
I see. I guess that's the kind of people that the organization really needs right now.
Well, you need someone with a farm background, with a love for his constituency and with a knowledge of legislation and diplomacy.
Yes. When you're lobbying in Congress, you use the argument very much that the tobacco program is kind of the lifeblood of the small farmers.
Yeah, once you lose that, you haven't got anything to stand on. If you're dealing only with the big commercial farmer, he doesn't need any help in the eyes of most people.
I see. So that's really the main argument there.
That's right.
Keep the program for those small farmers.
That's right. I guess it was best put by a congressman from South Carolina one time when they were arguing about eliminating the tobacco program, and he suggested to them that most of our tobacco growers, if the program were eliminated, would go on welfare and would become a burden on the states wherever they might migrate to.
So that carried some weight.
That's right.
What about the future of this organization, the Dealers Association? Does it, will it continue to exist, you think?
I think it will, as long as the tobacco producers have a program, it will continue to produce. Once a program is eliminated, I wouldn't see that there would be any lifeblood or financial backing for such an activity.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you very much.